Vaccinations and why public health experts are so worried when kids don't get them. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says Maine has the fifth highest rate of vaccine refusal in the country. Last year, nearly 800 children started kindergarten in Maine without having received the recommended vaccines. In each case, their parents had to fill out and sign a refusal form. And in most cases, the reason given was philosophical, as opposed to religious or medical reasons. Public health officials are alarmed by the rising number of kids going without vaccines and are trying new strategies to turn the tide. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about vaccinations and what it means for Maine if more and more kids don't get them. We'll also hear what other states are doing to increase vaccination rates and what the risks are. Maine Calling talks vaccinations, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It's understandable why children may not want to get vaccinated. What kid likes a shot, after all? But there are an increasing number of adults who question the need or safety of immunizations. Today, we'll learn what Maine is doing when it comes to getting children vaccinated. We'll also learn about some of the common misperceptions about the safety of vaccines and the dangers associated with one segment of a population not being immunized from common diseases. With me in the studio, Dr. Laura Blaisdell. She's a pediatrician with Intermed and health services researcher with Maine Medical Center. Her research includes vaccine hesitation and decision-making. Dr. Amy Belisle is Director of Child Health Quality Improvement for Maine Quality Counts. Cassandra Grantham is Director of Child Health and Childhood Immunizations at Maine Health. Of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about vaccinations? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you. Dr. Laura Blaisdell, I'll start with you. Why are vaccine refusal rates going up in Maine? Why are people choosing to opt out of vaccines?
Gosh, if that was a simple answer, Jennifer, I think we wouldn't be having this show. I think it's a very complex reasons that people decide that they are wanting to have more information about vaccines. So getting into larger categories, I think there are questions about vaccine safety. There's questions about vaccine additives. There's certainly more vaccines on our vaccine schedules these days. And so there are more opportunities to be thoughtful about our choices that parents are making.
And why do you think Maine is among the highest? I mean, number five in the latest CDC report.
I think Maine, there might be a few reasons why Maine might be a little bit higher. Of course, there's our Yankee independence that always makes us think for ourselves. But also there are policy decisions like having exemptions to vaccines that are easier in certain states like Maine.
Okay, so Maine, one of, I can't remember the number, something about 17 states in which a child can be exempted if the parent fills out a form. In other states, that means that there are 33 states in which that's not an option. Dr. Amy Belisle, I'm going to turn to you. What is the worry? Why are public health officials so concerned that almost 800 children have gone to Maine, or have gone to kindergarten in Maine without receiving their vaccines?
I think we're concerned because we want to make sure that all the children and families in a community are healthy. And if we have a lot of families who decide that they're not going to vaccinate their child, then we don't have what's called herd immunity, where we have enough immunity in the community that's going to protect maybe a small child, an infant that can't get their immunizations, or an elderly grandparent who has cancer and is immunocompromised. We don't want them to get the diseases. And some of the things that we're seeing right now is an increase in whooping cough or pertussis. We're seeing outbreaks of measles. And we're seeing diseases that can cause significant illness in someone that is either vulnerable and cannot get immunized or a parent has chosen not to immunize them. So that's our concern. Once you start to get below 95% immunity, we start to see a decrease in the herd immunity in communities.
So if a community, if 95% of the population or more has had an immunization, this herd immunity is sort of in effect. That is the number, the magic number at which the community is not likely to have, anybody's likely to have this disease. But once we start dipping below that, that's when the risk becomes more real.
I think, yes, that's where the risk is more real. I think in our state, we see pockets of areas where there are families that choose not to immunize, and that's where we're also seeing those pockets of outbreaks of pertussis and measles. So that's where our concern is. But on the flip side, we are seeing a lot of work is happening across the state to improve immunization rates. So although the papers are highlighted the increase in the opt-out rate, we are seeing an increase generally in our immunization rates across the state. And there's a lot of good news happening. So that's another thing that we are excited to share with you today.
So there are more children getting vaccinated and more children and more parents having their kids opt out. So
exactly.
Both are going on at the same time. Cassandra Grantham, what are the challenges in convincing parents to get their children vaccinated? I understand with many public health issues, it's a matter of education. But in this case, it's often very highly educated people who are opting out.
That's true, Jennifer. And I think Dr. Blaisdell can probably talk a little bit more about the research related specifically to decision making around opting out of vaccinations. But we definitely see that with parental decision making, you would think that giving more information, more education, more facts would help people make their decision, and would, in our case, we would hope help them make their decision to vaccinate. But unfortunately, in this case, what we find is that by giving more facts, by sort of pushing information towards people, sometimes that backfires on us, and we need to be very careful and very cognizant of people's approaches to making decisions for their children, and understand that everyone's trying to make the best choice that they can with the information that they have available. And so physicians and other healthcare professionals really struggle with this issue, because the way that they were trained to talk to parents and community members you know, in their schooling was really around education. And this may be more of a shared decision-making process, or a more of a motivational kind of interaction with parents. And I think that that's a challenge for providers that haven't had an opportunity to get information about how to talk with parents about this.
Dr. Blaisdell, walk me through the process a little bit. I'm a parent of kids, and I've taken my kids in to get their vaccinations, and I'm handed a sheet of paper that I'm sure you as a pediatrician have handed out lots and lots of times that explains the vaccination, but it also explains the risks of a vaccination, and it also talks about a federal fund that's been set up to compensate people who are harmed by a vaccine. So just in that piece of information that's given right there at the pediatrician's office, for some, I can imagine that would raise a huge red flag. Can you explain that piece of paper and explain what the risks are of the common vaccines that every child, you would like every child to be getting?
I think what you're referencing is the vaccine information sheet that is commonly used at times of vaccination with children. I think that one thing that you're highlighting is that the information is very complex. It's not necessarily complete, and it may conflict with what parents have read before coming in for their child's vaccinations. I think that's one aspect that I'd like to comment on from what Cassandra was saying, is that making meaning of vaccine information is one of the cornerstones of what I do with families, is how do we take all this information about risks of the disease, potential risks of the vaccination, our individual lifestyle choices, and end up coming to a decision about what we're going to do today in vaccinating children. And so that meaning-making process is essential when we work with parents.
So tell me about a conversation with a parent. Have you had a parent come in and say, I'm really nervous, I don't like the idea? What's the big one? When your baby's DTaP, when you have a little baby,
right,
and it's got four different vaccinations, yep, in one shot. You know, this really makes me nervous to have this tiny baby that I love so much have all this injected into him or her at once. What do you say?
I think the first is, I'm a mother. I hear you. It is whenever the decisions that we make for our children seem conflicting or difficult, it leaves us in a place of questioning and uncertainty. So I try to start with that, saying that I too felt a little nervous when I was vaccinating my own two sons. I think that a lot of parents have certain questions about whether or not getting the disease is healthier, whether or not the additives that we have in the vaccinations are safe, whether or not having so many vaccines at once is safe for a child's immune system. And the fear of harming a child is certainly goes along with that. So I think it's important to start and to listen where a parent is coming from and what sorts of worries are most salient to them today, and to work through that and to realize that we can always change our decisions and that we can, although we have a vaccine schedule, we can work with parents to meet them where they are that day, and we're in it together.
Okay, but your overall message to parents is always, please do get your child vaccinated.
Yes, I think ultimately these diseases will come back, and I'm working very hard to make sure that they don't. And so I believe that they're safe. They were safe for my children, but that doesn't mean it's a shared decision-making process that we go through together.
Dr. Belial, what kind of efforts are underway right now to boost the immunization rate in Maine?
The state's actually been very fortunate. As 2010, we received what's called a federal CHIPR grant. So the state of Maine and Vermont have been doing work to improve child health care quality over the past 4.5 years. So we did a large focus on immunization rates, and we worked with many of our partners in state government and across the different health systems to improve rates. We worked with 24 practices that provide primary care to children, both pediatric and family medicine. And over 26 months, we've raised their immunization rates by 11%, which is a huge amount. We had focused on not only raising 2-year-old immunization rates, but also 6-year-old, so before school, and 13-year-old immunization rates. So we are doing a lot of work across the state to raise immunization rates at the practice level. We're also, Cassie Grantham's been working with the Maine Health Child Health Immunization Task Force, with the different health systems and the providers, but she's also been doing a lot of work with families and developing easier materials to understand about immunizations. We've also been working with the practices so that they can develop systems so they can remind families when they're due for an immunization or they've missed a shot or when to come in. So we're really doing a lot of work at many different levels to improve the immunization rates. And interestingly, the state of Maine just was a recipient of 4 national immunization awards from the federal CDC. They got 2 awards around raising immunization rates for adults, but they had 2 awards. One was for improving flu vaccine in children, and the other was one of the most improved for toddler immunization rates, so kids under 3 years old, improving their immunization rates. So the state's actually getting a lot of recognition nationally for the work that's been happening over the past 5 years. And one last point is the state has the universal coverage law. So now vaccines are available for children at no cost under the age of 19. This has been a really important development. A lot of groups, including the Maine Vaccine Board and the insurers, they now put money into a pool so that children can get vaccines at no cost. So access is not an issue. So that's been a really important development since 2012.
That was one of my follow-up questions for both you and Cassandra is how do low-income families afford this? And that's the answer, that the universal access you can get. How does a child from a family that may not have health insurance, how does one access? You're nodding, Cassandra. Give us
So the most wonderful thing about the Vaccine for Children's program, which is how we get our vaccine for low income or children who are uninsured or underinsured, comes from the federal government. And the best thing about it is that no practice, no provider can turn away a child for lack of ability to even pay a very small fee called an administration fee. So when someone comes into a practice and they want to receive immunizations, normally what happens is they need to be a patient of the practice, so they become a patient of the practice, and then they actually can get their immunizations. The vaccines themselves are completely free, as Amy mentioned. A practice has the right to charge a very small fee for actually giving the shot to the child, because that's a process they have to be very careful about, and so they can bill for that. But no child can be turned away for a family's inability to pay that fee. So effectively, vaccination is free in the state of Maine up until 18 years and 355 days, essentially. You know, it's 64, I meant. And so I think the most important thing to remember is that people worked really hard to get this into action here in Maine, and that we're really lucky to be able to have our kids go to any practice and get these vaccines without having to worry about the cost.
The phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to our Facebook page. I'll throw this out to whoever wants to answer it. Have vaccines changed? Are there different kinds of preservatives in them, for example, than there used to be?
It's the hesitation in answering that question is vaccines, there's so many of them. Yes, vaccines have changed, and they have become, they have been improved. Some have been removed. There are new techniques and additives that have made them safer. So yes, vaccines have changed over time. And I think one example would be the whooping cough or pertussis vaccine that we had in 1970s. That vaccine caused very high fevers, and sometimes seizures came from those high fevers. And so it was a whole cell vaccine, so meaning that it was very, very potent, and the immune system reacted to it. It also meant that we didn't have to boost as many times. But we decided that that vaccine had too many side effects as a medical community, and went back to the vaccine that we're using now, which has a lot fewer side effects. It has some additives that allow us to cause the immune system to notice it, but not go quite into overdrive as it did before. But we do have to boost more often, and that's why you see multiple times we are asking parents to vaccinate against whooping cough, and again at age 9 to 10.
And I think it's amazing that, we do have so many more vaccines than we did even when I was a child. And when I was getting ready to immunize my children, my mother actually was a bit hesitant about the number of shots my kids were going to receive at each appointment. And I think what is important to remember about that is that we've figured out how to protect kids from other diseases that we weren't able to protect them from a while ago. And if you can protect a child from something like chickenpox, why not, you know, do so so that they don't have to miss school, they're not itching until they're bleeding, things like that, that, you know, you kind of have to remind folks of that may have not experienced those, had the chance to experience those vaccinations.
Okay, so I want to return to chickenpox, but first we have to take a break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, committed to regaining mobility and getting rid of the pain. JointsME.org. Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainer's success. FameMaine.com. And Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. Take the news you count on with you, news.mpbn.net. It offers a clean mobile experience and the in-depth news you trust from both NPR and MPBN. News.mpbn.net, in-depth coverage of the most important stories taking place in Maine and beyond. It's easy to explore, and it's mobile-friendly, whenever and wherever you want.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the importance of immunizations. With me in the studio, Cassandra Grantham. She's Director of Child Health and Childhood Immunizations at Maine Health. Dr. Amy Belisle is Director of Child Health Quality Improvement at Quality Counts Maine. And Dr. Laura Blaisdell is a pediatrician and health services researcher with Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before break, we were talking very briefly about chickenpox, and I wanted to bring that back up because I know families that instead of having the vaccine for chickenpox have had chickenpox parties where they intentionally expose their children to chickenpox. And I'm wondering if there's anything wrong with that approach.
So as somebody who had chicken pox, I remember very distinctly my mother high-fiving me after I went to Nicole Perry's house and got chicken pox from her. So yes, this is not a new concept of going and getting chicken pox. It's certainly a disease that the later that we get in life, the more severe that it is. And so when we think about why do we not vaccinate or why do we vaccinate for chicken pox? I think Cassie before the break talked a little bit about the disfigurement of the pox themselves, the super infections that one can get. But oftentimes, harding back to what Dr. Belial said, was we vaccinate against chickenpox because we have so many folks in our communities who are living in immunocompromised situations. I have a wonderful friend who worked very hard to get a donated kidney, and if she was exposed to chickenpox, it could threaten her graft. And so that's one of the meaning-making stories that I share with parents to help them understand why I think that vaccinating against chickenpox is important.
Cassandra, what kind of research is out there about the safety of vaccines?
So what's really great is that that many different organizations have put a lot of time and effort into understanding the safety and efficacy behind vaccines. And there have been several recent studies that have actually come out looking at associations between vaccinations and different situations that kids may find themselves in, autism being one of them, but many others. And of course, we can't do studies that actually force families not to immunize their children so that we can look at what we would call like a randomized control trial. It's just not fair. And so what we have been able to do is look back over time at different populations of children. And we've actually found that kids who are immunized, completely immunized with all of the vaccines according to the schedule that Dr. Blaisdell was mentioning, the one that's recommended by the CDC, that they have no higher risk of getting autism and some of these other developmental challenges that families face than those kids that delayed or did not receive any immunizations at all. So we're finding that there is research that is now delving deeper into this topic and actually proving that the CDC's recommended schedule is safe and it does work and it doesn't increase risks of other situations for kids.
Okay, going to the phones now. And Jim in Sanford. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I wanted to go back to something that was brought up at the beginning where there was a brief discussion of people that are better educated and get more information. And they found, I believe, if I understood correctly, that they were less apt to get involved in this. And I think the reason might be a lack of trust of the government overall. People are looking at the Congress and the way that our government is not functioning properly, and I think that there's a general distrust of anything that comes out of the government at this point in time.
Is this something that you find in your research that, Laura, that people just generally speaking are distrustful of government because of history?
Yeah, I think that that is a very astute point. Thank you about the sense that we don't necessarily trust the large pharmaceutical companies or the government, because we've had issues in the past that have broken our trust as a public, and so that is a very important point to think about and something that I do talk with families about occasionally.
Okay, Jim, thanks for calling. We have an email here from Joel. He writes, I had the Gerald Ford's swine flu back in 1974 or so, which resulted in 500 cases of, is it Guillain-Barré syndrome with a few deaths?
Guillain-Barré.
Okay, yep. Thanks. In 1989, I came down with Guillain-Barré syndrome and I recovered fully. I was told by my doctor at the time not to get any vaccines because of the GB syndrome. My current doctor doesn't seem to think it's a problem. In recent years, I've had the flu vaccine with no ill effects. Am I at risk of getting GB syndrome again? I'm 63 years old. Thank you, Joel. I have a pediatrician here.
Oh, I now have said that I've aged out of giving adult advice. Great question. I think that I would have to defer as it being beyond my knowledge base at this point.
Okay, we have a bunch of nods on that. I'm sorry about that, Joel. We didn't. We have pediatricians in the room, but maybe you can't answer this question either, though. But a follow-up question might be, you know, people who are perhaps in their young 20s now, maybe listening to this program and thinking, I didn't get a lot of the immunizations that are available today. Is it ever too late? Is there a point at which you can go to your doctor and say, I want to catch up?
Certainly there are catch-up vaccination schedules. There are some vaccines that immunize against diseases that folks are no longer at risk for. We do know that these diseases hit certain age groups. So asking your doctor what vaccines you can catch up on is a great question.
Okay.
And I'll just add that we are really working with the adolescent population right now. So even though they might be in their late teens, early 20s, there are some new vaccines out there. One is called HPV that we're really trying to get boys and girls between the ages of 9 and 26 vaccinated. They need 3 shots. They need boosters for pertussis in this age group. And there's another vaccine for what's called meningococcal disease that we're really trying to get adolescents and young adults caught up in. So they might be new to some families because they've come out in the last 10 years. And we're really trying to get information out to get adolescents and young adults vaccinated.
You brought up HPV. It's really interesting because the recommendations have changed as I've raised my own children. When the information first came out, the focus was really on girls, but now the recommendation is also that boys receive the HPV vaccine. Can you tell us a little bit about it for those who don't have kids my kids' age and haven't been following this?
So the recommendations have changed. So originally, human papillomavirus is a virus and can cause cervical cancer, can also cause throat cancer, genital warts. Originally, a child needs 3 vaccines in the schedule, and you can start getting vaccinated at age 9. Originally, they had recommended that just girls get vaccinated, but not enough girls got vaccinated. And so really to try to improve the herd immunity, they're now saying boys need to get vaccinated. It is an expensive vaccine. It's about $130, but it is covered now with the universal coverage law in the states, so that should not be an issue for families. But, you know, part of the issue with the vaccines is really the social messaging. A lot of families, there's a lot of social hesitancy to get HPV because some of the diseases are associated with early sexuality. But we're really trying to change that messaging because it's really an anti-cancer vaccine. It's one of the only vaccines that we have that can prevent cervical cancer and some of the head and throat cancers. So we're really trying to get that information out to families. And we need to shift the focus on this vaccine because it's very effective. So we're really trying to get this information out to teens and their families.
Definitely. I would agree with Dr. Belisle. And I would just say also add to that to say that, research continues to be done on the HPV vaccine, and there are opportunities moving forward for an even better vaccine coming out that may protect against more strains of HPV. You know, as a parent of really young children, all my kids right now are under the age of 4, realizing that I have the opportunity to prevent cervical cancer and that my son also has the opportunity to prevent cervical cancer in any future partners that he has is a pretty incredible opportunity. And the other thing just to add is that, you know, I work with one doctor who messages to boys specifically about this vaccine. And his message is, do you want warts on your junk? If not, you might want to get vaccinated. And I know it sounds really kind of crass, but for boys between the ages of, 13 and 18, they're worried about that kind of thing. So it's kind of a nice way of thinking about it.
The phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, going to Tom in Farmington. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I hope I didn't miss this earlier. I just want to let you know I'm a parent with grown children, and I'm also the son of a physician. So we had both I and my children had little choice about whether we were going to be vaccinated or not. But I had 2 questions for your panel. I heard. I guess what I'd really like to know is what are the perhaps Dr. Belisle say are the specific reasons that parents who don't want to have their children vaccinated give for not wanting to have those children vaccinated. And my second question is, when you asked her earlier to explain what she says to parents when they you know, what her response is. I didn't hear her say specifically that she believes, I would think she believes, that they're putting their children's health at risk. And if that's the case, I was curious as to why she didn't say that. Thank you.
Doctor, I think that was you, Dr. Blaisdell.
Yes. Yep. So the second part of the question, I don't think I understood fully, but I think what I will clearly say is that I believe in vaccination. I believe in the vaccine, the CDC vaccine schedule. And I also believe with working with parents to make sure that their kids are safely vaccinated. I think for the specific reasons that parents come to me and say that they don't want their children vaccinated, I didn't mean to be vague, but there are as many reasons on the books as there are people. I think, as I said, you know, some people think that the necessity of the vaccines isn't, the vaccines aren't necessary. Getting the natural diseases healthier, like we talked about in chickenpox. Parents want to space out their vaccines because they want to see their child's immune system react. They feel like there isn't a high risk of diseases. And I think that a lot of parents feel that they can control their child's susceptibility to diseases. And while I may or may not believe that to be true, in fact, I believe that's not true, I feel like it's important to meet parents where they are and talk through those discussions without judgment.
Okay, our Facebook, lots of Facebook posts on this one. From Amy, if the pharmaceutical companies would offer separated shots, that could help. MMR rates may increase if shots could be given separately. What might it take to get these offered, like when we were kids?
So I might answer that.
Sure.
So yes, it would be great if we all had a sushi menu of the vaccines and we could choose which we want, you know, nigiri, sashimi, and so forth. But I think it's important to remember that each of these vaccines went through a 7-year trial period where thousands of families put their children at risk so that we could understand the safety of this disease. So that also comes at a cost of millions and millions of dollars. So when we talk about splitting up a vaccine that far and vastly has been researched to be safe, we're asking families to put their children at risk so that we can study a measles vaccine separately, and we're spending a lot of healthcare dollars to do so. So it would be great. Unfortunately, under competing circumstances of money and time and risk to individual study participants, we just haven't done that.
Go ahead, Dr. Blau.
And I'd actually take the opposite approach. One of the ways that we're raising our immunization rates is through combination vaccines. One of the reasons parents are hesitant is because they're worried about how many pokes a child might get at a visit. So one of the things they're doing is really trying to maximize the different combination vaccines at each visit so that kids get caught up and they're on time and on schedule. So we actually, I think, see the opposite effect, that combination vaccines have really improved our immunization rates in the state.
And Cassandra's nodding as well.
I would agree. Yep.
Yeah. We have a Facebook comment from Lydia. What are the risks for my children that have been given vaccinations when they go to school with the other children who have not received them?
I think speaking just from the public health perspective, the great news for you and your family is that your children are much less likely to get a vaccine-preventable disease than those who are unimmunized. You know, the risk is that for children who are unimmunized, that they can bring disease into the school. But Dr. Blau was mentioning earlier about herd immunity, and what we try to do is make sure that each school has enough herd immunity to prevent that from happening. If there is an outbreak and a child was to contract a vaccine-preventable disease, even if they were immunized, they're going to get a much less severe case of the disease. And I think we see, you know, in specifically in the cases of pertussis that have been circulating in Maine, and we've had spikes, as we've talked about, people are wondering, well, geez, I got my kid fully immunized against pertussis with the DTaP vaccine and the Tdap boosters. But what we know is that, as Dr. Blaisdell was mentioning, the DTaP vaccine has changed over time, and it's a little less potent. And so there are cases where kids who are vaccinated will get pertussis, but they are much less likely to get a severe case.
Okay, well, we have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do CEI. providing financing and development services for small and medium-sized businesses. Learn more at ceimaine.org. Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston committed to canning their entire line to protect the beer and the environment. BaxterBrewing.com. And Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life.
On the next Fresh Air, The New Puberty, we talk with Louise Greenspan and Juliana Deerdorf about why an increasing number of girls are beginning puberty at an early age, as early as 7. We'll talk about the possible causes and consequences. Greenspan and Deerdorf have written a new book and are conducting a long-term study of puberty. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock for It's Your World. A group of 2 policy leaders, security experts, and changemakers discuss why environmental sustainability must become a central tenet of U.S. foreign policy to protect our national security and promote global prosperity. That's It's Your World coming up at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Case for Vaccinations. With me in the studio, Dr. Amy Belisle, Director of Child Health Quality Improvement at Quality Counts Maine. Cassandra Grantham is Director of Child Health and Childhood Immunizations at Maine Health. And Dr. Laura Blaisdell is a pediatrician and health services researcher with Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. A Facebook comment from Patrice. I think one factor is that today's parents are too young to remember a time before vaccinations were widely available and don't realize how bad these diseases can potentially be. My older sister was paralyzed, thankfully temporarily, as a side effect of measles. I also remember pictures of children in iron lungs from polio.
This is Amy. I would agree. I mean, I think training in Portland just 15 years ago, we saw children die from vaccine-preventable diseases. One is meningococcemia. I saw several young adults who got sick very quickly and passed away. And that leaves a mark on you when you're training in medical school and residency. And if you talk to a lot of the older pediatricians in the state, they're very adamant that we need to be improving our immunization rates because they've seen all these diseases. And as we see a resurgence of pertussis and measles, diseases that we may not have seen as much 15 years ago now, I think people are starting to get scared because little babies with pertussis are very, very ill. So I think your caller is right. And I think there's every reason to be concerned if we don't continue to push people to get immunized.
And I'd like to add to that, Amy, I think that you bring up a very good point that we as doctors have sat by the bedside and watched people lose their children. And so that is, well, oftentimes behind a lot of our passion in making sure that it's not that child that's sitting in front of you that's going to be the next child that you sit and talk to a family about. And I think that, with the outbreak of Ebola, the first question has been, can't we get a vaccine? A lot of the diseases that we're vaccinating against now that are kind of boring now that we have a vaccine were just that scary when they were circulating in our environment.
Going now to Janelle in Oakland. Hi, Janelle. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. Going back to the pertussis thing, and I have a very grown son, but I'm not asking you for medical advice for him, but he has never had pertussis. At 5 weeks old, he suffered what was thought to be a pulmonary cardiac collapse, and his pediatrician always advised that he not have his pertussis for that reason. He's had everything else. He's, as I may have just said, he's 31, and he's a school teacher, which he would roll his eyes if he knew I was still concerned about my baby. But anyway, he's in another state now teaching. He taught in Maine for several years, and he and I have discussed it, and he, of course, thinks it's nothing to worry about, but he does still carry his note from his pediatrician explaining why he should not have it. What should he do?
Well, one question I would ask is if he had a tetanus. Sometimes pertussis can be linked into tetanus, but I think that when we have very scary diseases or events that we can't explain, it's prudent to be cautious. But if he is if he's healthy, and then he should certainly talk to his physician about getting that vaccine, because pertussis, as a school teacher or as a pediatrician, is a very serious thing that we can help prevent.
Yeah. Well, I thought so. I didn't know if they had a different type of pertussis vaccine they would get as an adult or whatever. But at the time, they thought he was a near SIDS that we happened to catch.
Mm-hmm.
But other things went on. So I'll take your advice to talk a little more with him.
Thanks, Janelle, for calling. Yeah, I'm sure you're used to that by now. Thank you so much. We have an email from Joel. He writes, I've had a mild case of shingles. I've heard there is now a vaccine for those of us who have already had shingles. Is that true?
Well, again, so there is a vaccine for shingles, and as a pediatrician, I don't give it very often, but I think that the chickenpox vaccine that we are giving now does help protect against shingles, and I would certainly encourage you to speak to your doctor about getting that, because shingles can be a very painful disease.
So if you get the chickenpox vaccine as a child, you're also immunized against shingles as an adult?
Immunizations, it's hard to say. We are vaccinating against chickenpox for children, and the waning immunization from that vaccine may or may not protect people.
So we haven't had enough time go by to figure that out
yet.
That's correct. Okay. Going to Amanda in Portland. Go ahead, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that all of the advice and that the doctors are basing their recommendations to vaccinate, and pretty adamantly, as evidenced by today's calling, the Today Show doesn't even have anyone proposing an alternate point of view. But I'd like to just say that a lot of these recommendations are based on CDC research, and CDC research, there's quite a bit of evidence suggesting that CDC is actually not being forthright in the representation of the research, as evidenced recently. There was a recent study with research showing that African-American young men were being adversely affected by a vaccination study that was being done, and they chose to not report that. And there was actually a resignation from one of the people involved in that study because of that. And, congressional advisory panels have noted that the CDC may not be completely forthcoming. There's an estimation that every year about 12,000 reports of adverse reaction to vaccinations are made to the FDA, but the FDA estimates themselves that 90% of doctors do not report serious reactions or any reactions. That is the doctor's reporting. That's their choice to report and determine in their own view whether something is because of a vaccination, and they suspect, FDA suspects it.
Okay, right? So I'm going to let, that's a lot of information already. I'm going to let the panel here respond to the, is the CDC choosing which information, choosing judiciously which information it releases?
So I think that you raise a good point, definitely that there's a lot of information out there. What do we believe? What is misinformation? What isn't? I think the report that the caller's referring to, unfortunately, one individual, it appears, made a bad judgment call. And I think that we need to think about it as, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. There's a lot of really good research that does come out of the CDC that is important, and that there are obviously going to be cases where, people don't make the right choice. But moving forward, I think we have, parameters in place. We have to make sure that appropriate research gets reported. And the caller also referred to reporting adverse events. And what I wanted, and I think that's a more important topic, actually, and to note that, yes, there are there are parameters in place for practices to report adverse reactions to the vaccine adverse event reporting system, which is the system that coordinates all of that.
So doctors are required to report adverse reactions to vaccines?
So they're required to report certain adverse reactions to vaccines. It does come up that, or it is within their purview to say, this is something I've seen numerous times. So for instance, pain at the injection site. Normally, that's not reported anymore. It's one that is well documented and is listed as Dr. Blaisdell was mentioning on the vaccine information sheet, low grade fever, et cetera. But I will note that with the HPV vaccine, a lot of adolescents experience syncope or fainting when they are receiving a lot of actually immunizations when they're in that age group, and we realized that syncope rates were higher in kids who are getting HPV vaccine because providers were reporting to VAERS that this was happening, and so we've been able to put rules in place and systems in place to help prevent those things moving forward. And we are training our clinical staff on when to report and what to report.
Oh, go ahead, Laura.
I think the only thing that I would add is yes, there is uncertainty in the data that we have. And we are living in a day where more and more data comes out every second. And we need to try to figure out how to digest that data and make it meaningful to us. The overarching bodies like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Practice, these groups are independent of the CDC and also look at vaccine schedules, also look at data to ensure that we are doing what's best and what's safest for patients.
Okay, we're running out of time. I want to get to a couple more calls going to Sanford and Andrea. Hi, Andrea, go ahead.
Oh, hi, thank you very much. Yes. My name's Andrea Bolin. I'm a state representative. I've brought a vaccine bill into the legislature three times to just allow parents to know what's in the ingredients in the vaccines and to remind them that they have the right to opt out because so many parents feel that they have to have their children vaccinated even if they have concerns about it. And one of the other pieces about that that is unpleasant is that if something, and they have, I mean, there's a reason why we have a vaccine adverse reaction registry. The reason is there have been very bad consequences for some children, not all, and I'm not saying what you should do, but whether to vaccinate or not, but there is no recourse for the families when there is an injury to the child by law. In the 1980s, a bill was passed at the federal level that protects doctors and drug companies from any legal liability. And the result is for parents whose children are badly injured, they pay the bill for years, and it can be very, very serious.
So, Representative Bolin, we're really short on time, so I'm going to throw this out to the panel.
The two comments that you made about additives, yes, it's really important to be aware of what additives are in vaccines. I routinely send parents to the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Vaccine Education Center. If you go to the vaccine ingredients section, there's a download of vaccine excipient and media summary where you can look at each vaccine, what additives or what additional parts and components there are to that vaccine. I encourage all parents to go there. And in terms of the injury, yes, it does sound very suspicious when doctors and pharmaceutical companies are protected from legal liability. I think as a physician, I feel liable for all of my patients when they have an adverse outcome. But we need to remember that that was also in the setting of a time where lawsuits were making pharmaceuticals opt out of making vaccines at all. And it made incredible vaccine shortages, and it made it difficult for us to provide any vaccination. And so that was the intent behind the law. And I appreciate you bringing that to light because it does sound a little suspicious without knowing the backstory.
Okay, just a minute left. Wondering what is the final message that you all would like to leave with listeners today, Dr. Belisle?
Well, when I think about vaccines, I mean, I'm incredibly proud of the work that's happening in the state of Maine to improve our immunization rates. We often tend to focus on the negative aspects in the news, but actually the state is doing a lot of work to improve immunization rates, and we've improved our immunization rates both for three-year-olds and for our adolescent rates consistently over the past couple of years, and the state's also covering these vaccines. So our state should be proud of the work it's doing, and we really want to encourage folks to get their vaccines. So.
Cassandra.
And I would say that I think to remember that most parents are vaccinating their children, that although a lot of the news focuses on increasing exemption rates and disease outbreaks, et cetera, most parents are choosing to immunize their kids, and they are actually trying to share that message on resources like VaxMaine Kids, which is a very local platform for doing so. And I would encourage all parents to get involved in that conversation.
Okay. And Dr. Blaisdell?
I don't think I would add much more except for to say that I really appreciate the conversations that parents bring into the office. I encourage more parents to have conversations with their pediatricians about these diseases, and I'm so glad that I'm not seeing them in the hospital anymore.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us today. Cassandra Grantham, Director of Child Health and Childhood Immunizations at Maine Health. Laura Blaisdell, a pediatrician with InterMed and health services researcher with Maine Medical Center. And Amy Belisle, Director of Child Health Quality Improvement at Maine Quality Counts. John Keimel ran the board today. Our volunteer, Cindy Hahn, helped produce today's show and answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about net neutrality. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.